I'm honored to present our guest today, Lily Ledbetter. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you today.
Well, for our audience, they'll say, that name, I know that name. Well, the way they know that name is from the Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, because the first bill that President Obama signed was a bill that you fought 10 years for, and it was the Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. It was a 10-year struggle for you to get this gender wage equity bill passed. You've been inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame with people like Billie Holiday. I mean, this is, you have an honorary law degree from, where is it from?
City University of New York.
And you are a hero and an inspiration to so many people. Tell us a little about your background, and then tell us a story of how you were catapulted, really, as a fighter on the national stage for women's rights and women's pay equity.
Well, really, I considered myself just an ordinary citizen, and I felt very privileged to live in the United States of America all my life, because I grew up in a very poor rural section of Alabama, and all I ever wanted in life was to have a good job, be able to support my family, educate my children, and save and build a nest egg and someday retire and enjoy the fruits of my labor. And then just a few years from retirement, I found out by an anonymous tipster where I worked at Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company in Gadsden, Alabama, where I was hired in February 5th, 1979, as a first-line manager, supervisor in the production part of the factory, that I was being paid 40% less than the three white male counterparts doing the exact same job. I thought about letting it go, but I just could not, because when I saw that note, I was devastated, I was humiliated, and it wasn't right, because equal pay law was signed in 1963 by President Kennedy, and Title VII was signed into law by President Johnson in 1964, and it's the law stated that I should be paid for equal work for equal pay, and I couldn't let it go.
Well, thank goodness for all of us that you didn't, but you had been working for almost 20 years. You had gotten Manager of the Year. Your performance reviews were outstanding, and you had said you had such a strong work ethic that there was never anything too hard or too dirty that you wouldn't do, and you kind of outworked everyone. Anyway, you would do two and three shifts, and so you were like the beacon of employees, and yet you found in your mailbox one day a handwritten note that had your salary and then the other manager's salary. And I imagine you were just stunned.
I was devastated. It was just humiliating. And the first thing that popped in my mind was my mind started racing and calculating all those hours of overtime, because being a first-line manager, we were compensated with overtime pay because we were required to work. It was just an understood fact of that job position. You worked when your peer was out or there was another job that needed to be filled. We knew that it was our job to fulfill it. My peer had a heart attack. I worked 2 months straight, 12-hour shifts every night. He took his vacation and personal time each year or was on special assignment. I worked my shift and his too. So that cost me and my family a lot of money. A lot of money, and I never turned down overtime. The whole time, the entire career of working at Goodyear, I worked every bit of the overtime that I was offered to help my family, because we were struggling like other families in middle-class America with two children in college and trying to make ends meet. But I couldn't let it go. And then I put the note finally in my pocket and tried to get through a 12-hour shift. But halfway through that night, I thought about my retirement is based on what I'm earning. My contributory retirement was a percentage, matched by a percentage. My 401k was 10% of my earnings, matched by 6% Goodyear stock. And Social Security today is based on what I earned while working all those years. So I will be, with my income, all those working years at Goodyear Tire and Rubber and on into retirement, a second-class citizen in my pay, and there's nothing I can do about it. But I couldn't let that go. I had to go to the Equal Employment Commission in Birmingham, Alabama, and file a charge. I was close to retirement, but I just couldn't let it go. I filed that charge, and the lady who did the interview spent over 3 hours with me. She didn't take a break. She didn't do anything except pull out of me all of the things that had occurred to me during my career. And I was embarrassed because I was in a management position. I shouldn't be having to go in and sound like a whiner or a complainer. And most of us in those positions, women want to work. We want the responsibility. We want to do a good job. And we have to work harder and smarter to prove our capabilities.
Well, when you then went back to work after filing these charges, what was the atmosphere like for you? What obstacles, did they put obstacles in your way?
Absolutely.
To try to intimidate you away from this courageous stance?
Well, I was in a new job without any job description to outline the responsibilities or a policy and procedure for. It was a new job, and it was very difficult, and none of my coworkers would talk to me because it wasn't healthy for their careers to seem supporting me. So they would turn even if they met me in the hallway, or if someone happened to be in the restroom when I went in, they'd walk out. They wouldn't stay because that's just isolation. That's the way it works. And so when they came up with the early out, later on, I signed and took that, which really was a mistake, but because I was 2 years really away from any retirement age.
But the new job was incredibly physically demanding and really kind of inappropriate for you to be assigned to that. Tell them what they had you do. You had been the manager.
Right.
Which was not exactly heavy lifting except mentally.
Yeah. And,
but they put you in a very grueling physical job.
Yeah, inspecting large truck tires and Hummer tires. The Hummer tires were the problem because they're so large they could only get 12 on a 3x8 truck. And my job was to take them off that truck and inspect them thoroughly, and then put them back on the truck and push them to the 18-wheeler to be loaded for shipment. I couldn't get them back on the truck I had no hoist, I had improper lighting, and I saw that the cards were stacked against me. That was the main reason that pushed me in to the early retirement. And one of my coworkers had shut a hydraulic gate on one of my knees, and I'd had surgery. The orthopedic doctor said, if you remain in this job, you will be a cripple in 2 years, which I really needed to work 2 more years to be 62 to retire.
But there were other dangerous things that happened to you. Not that, these are not accusations, but there were some very dangerous things that happened, like with your car.
Oh, yeah. My car was attacked and keyed, and I had a screw put in the side of a tire, which you knew you didn't pick up in normal driving. My windshield was cut out, and then the brake gear was taken loose, which could have killed me. But I complained enough that I got to move my car inside the gate for a while. But the thing that I couldn't let go when I saw that note and filing my charge, and some months later, EEOC did an investigation. They called. They said, you've got one of the best cases we've ever seen. You probably would want to consider getting your own attorney and getting to trial earlier. And so I started searching, and I found a young attorney, John Goldfarb, in Birmingham, Alabama. He'd never lost a case. And he was very, very good in negotiating settlements in these type cases. And really, for an individual who files a case, a charge like this, a decent settlement is the best way to go, especially when there is a case. Now, I understand a company going up against an individual if there's not a case. I had a case, and the EEOC supported me all the way through the 11th Circuit. But we went to federal court, finally, in 2003. I filed the charge in 1998. I found the attorney in 1999. We got to federal court for trial in my home county of a federal jury of 7 people in January of 2003. After a week, the verdict came back. We find in the plaintiff's favor $3.8 million. But the judge advised the foreman of the jury and all of us in the courtroom that me, being a white female, I was only entitled to $300,000. So my $3 million suddenly dropped to $300,000. On back pay, individuals need to realize that you can only go back 2 years. Hmm. 2 years. So the judge took the lowest paid male in the area I worked, calculated my pay on his, and he just transferred into that area from a lower paying job, already making almost $600 a month more than I did. And he'd only been with Goodyear a little over a year. And I had been there then for 19 years. Plus, but that's, and I left the courtroom with $360,000.
But the next step was that Goodyear appealed this decision. And through appeals back and forth, you ended up at the United States of America Supreme Court.
Supreme Court, absolutely. It was it's an awesome feeling to walk in that huge courtroom and to hear your name attached to a case. But it's very impersonable. But the problem is the law was not interpreted when it got to the Supreme Court as it had been always, always in years past, which is based on the paycheck accrual rule. Each time an individual gets a check, that starts a new accounting period. And there's not any reason for an individual like myself to wait. We're working for our families. Had I known earlier, like Justice Ginsburg wrote the dissent, he said I should have filed my charge the first time I got that discriminatory paycheck, even though I didn't know it, even though I couldn't prove it.
But Justice Ginsburg pointed out in that dissent, and the decision was 5-4 against you, but Justice Ginsburg said, look, in many work environments, it is forbidden for employees to compare notes about how much they're being paid.
It was at Goodyear.
Yeah, and so you couldn't find out.
Right.
And then they said, oh, well, the statute of limitations has run out. And what I love about Ginsburg, and tell me a little bit more about why this was so important to her. But in her dissent, she said, the ball is back in Congress's court. This law has to be changed. But why was it so important for her? What Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's background made her so responsive to your problems?
She had suffered discrimination in her early career as a lawyer. Being a female, she had been told many times that she would be paid less than her male counterparts. But that was back in the day before these laws had gone on the books. And today, that's totally illegal. But when I hired in at Goodyear, they told me if I discussed my pay, I wouldn't have a job. And Goodyear has told on interviews that they wished I had come to them first. I did. And my superior told me that I was listening to too much BS from the men. And when I would ask about how did I rate with my peers, he said, well, I really don't know. I'll check. A week or so later, I'd ask, and he said, well, I hadn't had time, Lily. I'll check. Well, that would go on until I would realize he's not checking for me. He's not interested. He's dropping it, and I might as well, too. I just hit a stone wall when I tried to find out. But what I need to share with your audience, too, these cases are extremely hard on people. It's extremely hard on their families. You really find out who your true friends and supporters are. And also, it's your family life goes on. You don't devote every minute. My husband became very ill. We went through two major back surgeries. And then he had four cancers, which he had to have 34 radiation and chemo. When I went to the Supreme Court, my daughter traveled there with me, and I left him at home with a home health care nurse because they had just removed the left side of his face and grafted his skin from the right leg. And when I returned after the first of the year of that year, he started radiation and chemo. And we finally got to the Supreme Court in 2006. And the verdict then came out the next May in 07. But it was not no longer about Lilly Ledbetter. It was about my daughter, my granddaughter, and all of the working women across this nation and their families.
And we all, the working women of this nation and our granddaughters and our daughters, thank you for that. So as a result of losing at the Supreme Court, Congress took it up, and the new bill that was signed by the president in 2009 changes the Civil Rights Act so that workers can sue up to 180 days after receiving a discriminatory paycheck. So the Supreme Court was saying, well, you should have fired back in 1979 when you were first hired, but you didn't know.
I didn't know. I had no way to prove it.
It was only an anonymous tipster that brought this whole forth, who might be really kind of a hidden hero of all
That's
of
true.
This.
That's true. If I had not had that tipster, I would have not ever known. I would have retired and been struggling on through the rest of my life, not understanding really why. But, you know, the people who objected to the Ledbetter bill and fought us so hard against it, and that's an amazing feat, too. That was passed in 18 months. 18 months. Mm-hmm. But I had so many, many supporters across this nation, so many organizations, so many different groups. A lot of men got on the bandwagon because they understand it. It takes two people in middle-class America just to hold on to their positions today. It takes two incomes. And single mothers, they are struggling. It's costing our school children, 12th and undergrades. Their obesity problem is a result of their mothers not being able to cook and prepare meals. Their education is shortchanged because their mothers have to work. They can't go to parent-teacher conferences. They don't have time to go to school functions. And this nation is falling behind. That's why it is so important that we get equal pay for equal work. What the law states that we should be entitled to.
Well, they call April 28th of every year Equal Pay Day because a woman has to work that far into the year to finally then be making the same as a man.
What the man made the year before.
Yeah, yeah.
It takes 16 months to make what the man made the year before. We're still, you know, when equal pay passed, we were 59 cents.
Yeah.
White women. And, of course, the Hispanics and the minorities are even less. And then today, we're only making 77 cents. We haven't come up very far.
Well, you've focused so much attention on this, and we talked about the strain and the threat you were under to make this courageous stand. But let's talk a little more about the people who helped you, because I know that Hillary Rodham Clinton was a great support of yours. Michelle Obama said on Larry King that after her mother, you were her hero. And so you got to go to the White House for the signing. You got the first pen with which the president signed the bill. And actually, you even got to go to the inauguration. I mean, it's just a wonderful reward for the sacrifices that you made. But talk about some of the people who have supported you.
Oh, the groups in Washington were just amazing. The coalition helped bring me to Washington, the National Women's Law Center, that's in Washington, the AAUW, the Feminist Majority, all of the ACLU. I mean, it's just on and on and on. All of the groups, and we'd have rallies on the Hill. And I'd be out front with the politicians, and those other ladies was in the background waving those signs, AAUW, National Women's Law Center, and ACLU, all of them. And they were just tremendous. And one of the magazine articles that I have read, and, of course, I've saved all I get my hands on for the future generations, but it stated, she struck a nerve. And when I struck that nerve, the outpouring across this nation has been just tremendous. My attorney said, don't get caught up in all of this publicity. It will die. It never has. Yeah. And as long as I have a breath, I hope I keep it going, because it will never do Lilly Ledbetter a dime's worth of good. But the people that's out there working and trying to support their families, that's what it's all about. And our work is not done. There's still loopholes big enough that dump trucks can be driven through. We've got to close those because the Paycheck Fairness, I was sitting in the balcony last November when it failed by two votes. And had that bill been the law in my day, I could have found out where I stood. Mm-hmm. I would not have let this happen to me and my family because that was why I was working.
Well, so it comes down to what I need to ask you is what we can do. And you talk about the Fair Paycheck Act,
right,
which is the other part of the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Wage Act. And then there are still states that have not ratified the Equal Rights Amendment. One other group that's done so much is the American Association of University Women, the AAUW, because you've told me that they will support, you must get boxes, you must get letters from people begging for help with their cases. There are so many people that have been wrongfully, that have been discriminated against. But the AAUW, if you have a good case, will help you, even if you're not a university person.
That's true. They, even though you're not an academic, as long as you have the college degree and, you know, you're a professional and you have a good case, they will help you. And I help them raise funds, and they raised $50,000 last year just to help with that work. And I've been in many fundraisers with them because it is so important, because there are very few attorneys today that can afford to work for someone like my attorneys did. They have a lot of money in my case because they were pro bono. I could not afford an attorney that could go up against a corporation because they have big
deep pockets.
They have deep pockets and a lot of money, and they can hold on and you know, the individual runs out of money.
Oh, they wear you
so
down.
They need hope. They need help and hope, and they need a support, and that's what they do. The National Women's Law Center in Washington, D.C., people need to get connected to them, as well as the AAUW, the American Association of University Women, and learn what's happening, learn the laws, know what they're entitled to, go online, do their research. And then one thing I've learned through this journey, each of us have a voice and we have a vote, and we need to consider that vote when we exercise it very, very seriously. I no longer watch at the TV or read the newspaper headlines and base my vote on that. I research that individual. I want to know what's in his or her background. If they've ever held an office, I want to know how they voted. What did they support? What did they not support? And if we don't support the women of this country, we are going even further behind. So we need to get more women into politics, into corporate boards. You can see a corporate board announced, there'll be one female. And it's still front page headlines when a woman gets appointed to a Fortune 500 manager's job or a corporate board in one of those corporations. It's still headlines, but the men, they don't even announce it. It's just, you know, it's old hat. And we should be further down the road than this. Alabama, the state I come from, we just last year elected the first female ever from that state to Washington Congress. First time ever.
Well, people who want, you have a book coming out.
I do.
It's called Grace and Grit. Wonderful cover of you with all the tires mm-hmm. behind you. And is that can be found on Amazon and in your local bookstore. But one of the things I read was that you had talked to your pastor, and you said that one of the things you wanted to do was to live your life so that at the end, when he was speaking at your funeral, he could say, this woman made a difference in our world. You've made such a tremendous difference for all the women in this country. I just can't thank you enough. And do you have just, I know you want us to pay attention to who we vote for and not to be swayed by the advertising, but what else can we do in our communities to help, you know, fight for equality among the genders as you did?
Get involved and be supportive of each other. Women, I think sometimes we can be our worst own enemy, but we need to support each other.
If there's someone listening in our audience who feels that they've experienced this kind of wage discrimination and they're just trying to decide whether to fight it or not, what would your advice be?
They need to call the Equal Employment Commission is the first step, and to share their, make an appointment and go in and present their case to an investigator, and then they will tell them whether or not they have a case. That's the first step. And a lot of times now, they are more staffed, better staffed across the nation. They have a little bit more funds right today across the country, and they are taking on a lot of these cases, which probably had they taken mine on, we might have got, you know, might have gotten a better settlement offer, but Goodyear never would make a decent offer. I mean, it was an insult to my intelligence and even to the attorneys.
Well, our guest today is Lily Ledbetter. You are a hero and inspiration to so many people. Thank you for what you've done.
Thank you for having me and letting me share my story. Thank you.
Our guest today is Calvin Smith. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
You are the executive director of the Western History Museum in Hobbs, also the Lee County Hall of Fame. I just want to show, this is one of your wonderful publications.
Yes, that's our newsletter.
Yes, and so you're really a beacon of light down there. But I've asked you, you've really taught me a whole lot about archaeology, particularly in New Mexico. So tell us a little about your background, and you will lead us into the reason I brought you here.
I got interested in archaeology through Boy Scouting and picked up my first arrowhead on a field trip, and I wanted to know more about that, just that point, just that single point. Who made it? When did they make it? How did they use it? Where did the material come from? And I still am looking for those answers, and it's been a long time ago. But I've enjoyed a 45-year career in museums. I actually was the first curator at Blackwater Draw Museum when I was going to school at Eastern. I got a dollar check, and I still have it for my work, which made me a professional. I was also director of education at Texas Memorial Museum at UT. Taught classes there, and then the first budget cut came, and I went to become the director of the Spindletop Museum at Beaumont. And another budget cut came, and I went to work for little Billy Clinton in Arkansas, who was then governor the first time around, and was director of Arkansas Museum Services. And then finally ended up at Waco, where I was the first director of the Dr. Pepper Museum and Free Enterprise Institute. Fortunately, I grew up on Dr. Pepper, not Coke, but it was a good experience. And then I went to work for Baylor University in 1983, retired in 2003 as chairman of the Department of Museum Studies and director of what became the Mayburn Museum Complex.
You were born... Where were you born, in Lee County?
In Odessa, but moved to Lee County in 1954.
Right.
And my dad worked for Phillips Petroleum Company 45 years, and I grew up in a company camp, all long since gone, a different society completely, and saved my money working in the oil fields, went to the University of Arizona to major in anthropology, archaeology, and starved out. My checks... from the oil field didn't match what I had to write in Arizona. So I went back and had been offered a scholarship at Eastern New Mexico University and said, I'm not going to that podunk school, and ended up with 3 degrees from there.
Yeah.
Actually four, but couldn't get 2 masters at the same graduation ceremony. So.
Well, and now you're back at your roots, and I'm hoping that you can tell us, you mentioned all these other sites, but New Mexico has some of the rarest, important sites. And one of the ones that I want you to talk about is the Folsom Man Discovery Site, because you say it is probably the most historically important archaeological site in New Mexico.
In North America.
In North America?
Yes.
Okay.
A little background. I did this out of guilt. I really had the opportunity to meet Mrs. Grayson Mead, who was the wife of Grayson Mead, who I was investigating at the time, because he was probably one of the very first geoarchaeologists. He was a geologist, but he was into archaeology, and he was starting to bring the two fields together. And I went up to visit with Mrs. Mead in Agate, Nebraska. and that turned out to be a life event for me. She was the daughter of Harold Cook, who was the first professional on the Folsom site.
Yeah.
And she gave me a lot of original photographs that he had taken. And so I felt guilty for 40 years now about not doing something with them. And then almost 2 years ago now, I was asked by the American Association of Museums to do a museum assessment for the Folsom Museum. And I've done lots of those, including accreditation visits and other visits. And I wasn't going to do any more. I've got plenty to do. But when they said Folsom, I said, I will. And I went up, and incredible small museum. If you haven't been there, you need to go by, because it's in an 1890s general store, and everything is still there. It's just an incredible experience. But in that is an exhibit on Folsom. And it was kind of not quite what the public would expect from a regular museum. And so I offered what happened is that they told me that the Folsom site, which is west of Folsom, New Mexico, was actually declared a state monument in the 1950s. Now, think about how many state monuments have been created and improved and buildings erected, and there's still nothing there. And so I offered at that point in time to use the photographs and my knowledge of the Folsom site to put an exhibit together. And I wanted to make it a portable exhibit so they could put it in a vehicle and take it all over the state, because I felt like that people just aren't aware of this particular site. And so as I started to put it together, two elements came racing back to me as I re-researched the whole effort. One was that George McJunkett, a black cowboy, who became the foreman of the Crowfoot Ranch, was, for that day and time, was at the height of his profession. He was born in Texas but came to New Mexico at an early age, and was an extraordinary rider, roper, as a matter of fact, a fiddle player. But he actually was in charge of many white cowboys, and for that day and time, that's quite rare. He could also read and write, which was also, for that age, was rare. And as it turned out, he, after the flood of 1908, which took out most of Folsom, the small village of Folsom, and it also created, and something else a little known, created the one of the foremost heroines in New Mexico.
Yes, Sally.
The telephone operator, you don't think the telephones were around in 1908, but they really were. Most of the large ranches and families had telephones. And so she stayed at her post calling everybody she possibly could and was swept away and killed.
So she was calling to warn them.
That's right.
And
that's
at the risk of her own life, but how many lives she saved.
Absolutely.
I need to back up a little bit to remind our audience of our state's geography. So Folsom is in Union County, which is in the northeast corner of the state.
Right.
I think of it as being 7 miles from the Capulin volcano.
That's right. That's right.
So that's kind of a geologic and geographical focal point.
Right. It's kind of between Clayton and Raton, right up on the corner of Colorado and New Mexico.
Right. Right. So along came the flood,
right,
which had exposed some of these things. This gentleman, McJunkin, found
yes.
it.
Yes.
And then I think you have some pictures of some of the early early excavators and the
yes.
on the sites, because they're so evocative to me of that 1920s National Geographic, when all this boom in archaeology.
Right.
So if you could show us one or two.
The interesting part from the standpoint of realizing its importance was that Cook, Harold Cook, who was paleontologist at the Denver Museum of Natural History at the time, had been down to Lone Wolf Creek, Texas, which is near Colorado City, Texas, and had excavated a bison, which is an extinct form of bison, which is much larger than the ones that we call buffalo. These are Bison antiquus, And these animals were 7 feet at the shoulder, had a horn span of up to 6 feet. In fact, this particular one came from the permafrost in Siberia. And you can see the size. These are the actual horns, and not not the actual the horn cores. And we actually took a portion of this horn and got DNA from it. And we now know that they are not kin to our bison or buffalo. They're a totally different species.
Really?
But as it turned out, Cook found two other gentlemen from Colorado City, Texas, found this bison, Ivy Webb and Nelson Vaughn. And Cook went down and actually blocked up the rib cage and the points and took them back to the Denver Museum of Natural History. And he reported in Science Magazine, 1925, of this discovery, putting humans, as he put it, good, dependable, definite evidence of human artifacts in the Pleistocene in America has at last been found. And he was ridiculed, almost run out of the profession, because at that point in time, the dominant opinion was that humans arrived in the New World only a few centuries before Columbus. That's ludicrous to us today, because we have 70-plus different language types. We have the high civilizations of Central America. We have the mound builders. We have the Pueblos. Yeah. So it took thousands of years to develop those cultures and languages. But Cook was devastated. He was trying to find that next site where he could prove that humans were involved with the killing of these extinct animals. And it happened to be Folsom. He had a connection that he had worked on a ranch near Raton and knew the banker there and the cattle inspector, Howarth. Well, Howarth got involved by going out and visiting with McJunkin to see these bones. And we don't know whether there was a point found at that point in time or not, but he did bring it to the attention of the Museum of New Mexico. And they didn't appear to have any interest.
I'm sorry.
So they went to the Denver Museum of Natural History. And Cook and Figgins, the director there, decided that it was worth investigating, if no more than to get a specimen for as a skeleton, a complete skeleton. And they started that excavation in 1926. And they found some points, they found the bones, but all of them were removed before they could identify one that was still in situ or in place. The next season, Schwaheim, who was the local blacksmith at Raton, who had connected with McJunkin as well and had known about the site, was the field coordinator for Cook and the Denver Museum of Natural History. Well, he found the very first point in situ. And it is called now a Folsom Point. And this particular point, as a young graduate student at the Eastern New Mexico University, I didn't know any different, so I went to the Denver Museum of Natural History and asked if I could cast that point, make a replica of it. And they took it out of the case, and here it is. This is my cast of that particular point.
Well, we'll do a close-up of that.
And the it just was coincidence, divine fate maybe, that at the same day, this was on August the 29th of 1927, the first Pecos Conference, which was a professional conference held at Pecos Pueblo, was started that day. And so we had the big dogs there. We had the director of the Field Museum, the director of the American History Museum. We had all of the major archaeologists in America at that point in time. And so they came down to look at the point in situ. And in all good things do happen for Cook in this case. He Cook was taking pictures, and Figgins, the director of the museum, Barnum Brown from the American Museum of Natural History, Frank H.H. Roberts from Smithsonian's Bureau of American Ethnology, and A.V. Kidder from the Carnegie Institution saw this point in situ and said, this is it. And so this was the first time that humans had been accepted as part of the late Pleistocene in the Americas, which had to be 7,500 years old or earlier. As it turns out, the Folsom Point and the Folsom culture is about 10,000 years old.
So this was an absolute game changer.
Oh, yes.
And the fact that in some of these excavations of these extinct animals, they actually find the points in the vertebra.
Yes.
I mean, it's absolute proof.
Yes, yes.
That man was hunting.
Yes,
these
and
animals
killing,
at that time.
Yes, there were lots of bones missing from this group of bison. They were cut marks on the bone where they had actually butchered it.
Yeah.
So yes, it was real. This is Barnum Brown and Schwahim, who is pointing to the point that I just now showed at the original site.
Yeah, yeah. And that, again, you know, we've come so far from the thrill of those early discoveries. And so we'll put that actual history aside, and I'd like to look at some of the artifacts now. And why is... So the Clovis Point was much... The Folsom Point was much more sophisticated than the Clovis Point.
Yes, if you can get this. This is the classic Folsom Point, the type point, as a matter of fact. And you can see a groove or channel up both sides.
Right.
And that is the ultimate in flint technology, napping technology, because you can't take a flaking tool and make that what we call flute. It has to be by indirect percussion, which means that you had to have some vehicle by which to make that long flute.
Yeah.
And the idea of that flute is that you have a foreshaft, a lot smaller than this one, but the point goes on it, and it's the flute actually makes it so that it's much smaller entering the animal.
Mm-hmm.
And really, with the force of the atlatl and the dart, all you wanted was a sharp tip on the end of this foreshaft. And here's the process. You have a reed, which is called switch cane. It grows along the rivers. And you have a foreshaft, which can be wood or, in some cases, bone or ivory. And then in this case, I'm going to show a Clovis Point, which is earlier, but it is the predecessor to the Folsom because of the flint, the technology involved. And you put it in your foreshaft, and you grind the basal edges here so that the lashings aren't cut. And then you use the atlatl, which is an extension of your arm. I can't do it in here, but...
Yeah, no.
it gives you a longer arm, more force and leverage. And you put this right here, that's antler end. You put it like this, and you cast this overhand. And when it comes off of the atlatl with this... there's so much force that the dart itself, this is called a dart, this cane, actually bows like this.
Wow.
And it straightens out at about 15 yards, and it can go. One of our colleagues, Dr. George Frison from the University of Wyoming, went to Africa, tried it on an elephant, and put it into the animal 30 inches.
Wow.
So it could kill an elephant, literally.
So it could kill mastodons, bison.
That's right.
And those other, I think they're called megafauna.
That's
the
right.
Big animals.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we're learning more each day. That's the exciting part of this profession. You know, for instance, there's brand new articles all over right now about the earliest humans in North America, which is a new paradigm shift as well. And I think our colleagues are about where Kroeber and others were back in the 20s and the immediate acceptance, but it looks very promising. We have evidence now that humans came just as much out of Iberia as they did Siberia. I was taught that they came across Beringia.
That they came over across the Bering Strait.
But now we have evidence of this big blade technology being centered in Europe, coming across same time period during the advance of the ice ages and coming along that ice cap into North America. Our earliest dates now in North America are on the East Coast, not in Yukon or Alaska.
Yeah.
They're on the East Coast as far back as 20,000 years.
Well, that's amazing. So let's just... So the rallying cry for this is Iberia or Spain, the Iberian Peninsula,
yes.
Not Siberia, Russia, and the Bering Strait.
I think it's both. I think we're all the sites that we're working right now are pushing back further, and I think we'll probably find that the Alaskan Peninsula and that area will show early dates. I don't know that it'll be this early. We haven't found it yet. But then we look at these new dates that are coming out, which are good, solid dates. One in Pennsylvania at about 15. One in
15,000 years ago.
That's right. Yeah. I'm sorry. I just
No. I just want to remind our audience that we're talking huge in the evolution of the planet. This is a big chunk of time.
Yes, it is.
And we thought before it was like maybe 5,000 years ago. And now we're pushing that time zone back to 15,000 years ago. Man created tools and used them to hunt animals that are now extinct.
That are very large beasts.
Yeah.
And it took this size of projectile to actually, and with the kinetic energy produced by the atlatl and the dart and the foreshaft, to bring down an animal of this size. So it's an incredible technology just to even think about trying to make a living during that time period, because you had your other predators. We were a predator. But,
yeah, we were in competition with saber-toothed cats.
Dire wolves.
Short-faced bears.
Yes. Which were bigger than our Kodiak bear. The dire wolf was 5 feet tall, so... your saber-toothed cat and the American lion, which was much larger than our African lion today. So it was a difficult time period for humans.
And I think I read that in Virginia they were dredging a river and they came up with a mastodon tusk.
Right.
Again, with markings of weapons created by man from this same time period that we're talking about.
Yes, that's right. It looked to be Solutrean, which the Solutrean people in Europe, they kind of disappeared about 20,000 years ago. And so if they were marine technology, they would have come along that coastal line all the way down and into Texas, which we have now a 17,000-year-old lake.
Huh. Well, it's amazing. It's really thrilling. And I really want New Mexicans to know that we really, Folsom and Clovis also,
absolutely.
Are in a way the center of this incredible new frontier of old knowledge.
The two sites that are benchmarks for American archaeology are Folsom, because of its importance, and Clovis, which became the Clovis culture, which for my period of in the profession, over 40 years, has been the oldest culture in North America. Now, we have stuff pre-Clovis. We don't know exactly what that is, but we think it is connected to Solutrean.
And so Folsom would be how much pre-Clovis?
It's not. It's post-Clovis.
Oh, okay.
It's about 10,000 years old. Clovis itself is about 13,000 years old.
Right.
And that's full-blown. We don't know what was before yet.
Right,
of course. We're still working on it.
Yeah.
But it is an incredible time to be a so-called archaeologist.
It certainly is. And it's an incredible time to be a New Mexican because we're celebrating our centennial.
That's right.
We all have the romance of what we call now the Old West, 100 years ago when we became a state. But thank you for bringing the romance of our ancient archaeology. Our guest today is Calvin Smith, director of the Western Heritage Museum Complex. Right?
Yes.
In Hobbs, New Mexico, also the Lee County Cowboy Hall of Fame.
That's correct.
Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.